Thank you, Michael, Rob, and Shelley for organizing such a nice program. I'm looking forward to the rest of it. So I'm from NCBI Computational Biology Branch, Computational Biophysics Group. And first I'll tell you what we are working on. We study proteins, and we study proteins at the different level of organization. We looked at the cellular level of organization and tried, for example, to map biochemical pathways with interactomes, protein-protein interaction networks. And then we zoom in into molecular level and study proteins, protein-protein interactions, try to assess effects of variants and disease mutations on protein interactions, protein function, and this would be the topic of this particular, mostly, at least the half of the seminar will be devoted to this topic. And then I'll also study regulation of protein-protein binding by phosphorylation, and our the most recent project includes nucleosome, especially variant nucleosomes. As you know, histones, very conserved proteins, they actually have some variants which have specific functions assigned to this variant. So we try to, and there are sometimes there are several amino acid differences already is associated with specific function of nucleosomes. So we try to model these variant nucleosomes and see how these functional structural features are coupled with dynamics of these nucleosomes. And we constructed the database of histone variants. If those of you who are working on chromatin or histones, so this is a new database which you can try. So briefly, what methods we use? We use bioinformatics methods, different sequence alignments, some methods which are widely used, well-known methods, and some other methods which we actually constructed. We made, we use structural modeling using different programs, like VMD, NAMD from Klaus Schulten group. We use energy calculations, different force fields, CHARM force field from CHARM consortium, Foldex from Luis Serrano, Beat Music, Pop Music from Marianne Ruman, and other methods. So some of the other methods we also made our own methods, which I'm going to talk about today. So we, I mean, heard for the last 2 days about fitness, fitness landscape, and mostly we heard about the fitness landscape at the population level, organismal level. But there are different levels. If we think about fitness, it could be understood and could be analyzed at the level of proteins as well, so molecular level. And protein fitness, again, I usually don't use this term in my talks. I usually say protein function. But since here, I decided even to include it in my title. So protein function, of course, proteins would function under certain requirements if they are foldable, if their state, native state, is kinetically accessible, if this state is more or less thermodynamically stable. And, of course, proteins, while they function, they have to perform a lot of interactions with other biomolecules in the cell. So they should be in a specific compartment to perform these interactions. And of course, the also fitness can be understood in the cellular level. Of course, proteins involved in protein-protein interactions are involved in many pathways, and disruption of certain interaction would disrupt certain pathways and regulation. And proteins are pretty robust. You know that many amino acid substitution wouldn't change much, wouldn't change structure, wouldn't change function. But at the same time, proteins are very evolvable, and they evolve. They can evolve different specificities based on the same scaffold, and they can evolve different structural sequence features, which would be coupled to their specific function. And we, I mean, the protein fitness landscapes have been studied by protein design and by other methods. And a variation in the protein, why they and how they would evolve, of course, may arise through genetic processes, like, say, mutations or recombination, and also can arise through post-translational modifications. And those variations, the genetic variations, they would be a result at the protein of the protein level. They will result in change in amino acid types, in insertions and deletions, truncation of polypeptide chain, or domain shuffling. So all this will bring the diversity and will create diversity among different proteins. With the kind of decreased cost of sequencing, now we have a lot of whole genome and also exome sequenced, hundreds. We have a huge number of variations which are recorded. But this is necessary but not sufficient in order to understand the origin of allelic variation and couple genotype to phenotype, to specific phenotype, and couple this variation to also disease phenotype. So in terms of this large number of variations which have been recorded in, say, DBSNP database from NCBI, you see that the number of this variation grows really rapidly. But the variations which are actually annotated with their phenotype, especially disease phenotype, this number of variation grows much slower. And this is HGMD database, which records the many new curated mutations and associated disease phenotype. And overall, there are many variations for which we don't know what they do. We don't know which phenotype they are associated with. And what is important, we don't know the molecular basis. What do they do to proteins if they occur in the protein coding regions? And for Mendelian diseases, there are many of them, even from OMIM, for which molecular basis are known. And of course, for cancer, and I'll tell you about cancer variations, cancer mutations later on. For cancer mutations, for large majority of them, their role basically is unknown.
So we talk about the types of variations. So SMD is single nucleotide variant. What is it?
Yes.
Non-synonymous.
Okay.
Yeah.
Actually, it's another question.
Yeah.
Just in the stored proteins, is there a sense of, you know, how often even a single mutation is often a problem versus not that you would actually expect to totally destroy or inhibit function? I mean, is there a sense of, you know, oftentimes in proteins this many, you know, codons, these many amino acids are really essential and usually in binding regions, and these may or may not actually matter, that you could sort of get a sense of, we would expect this many.
This is what I'm going actually to tell you, about that. So personal genomics, we live in the area of personal genomics. I don't know how many of you have their genome sequenced. So some of you, so. But actually, many of us sequence our genomes, but annotation is a problem for many mutations. And where personal genomics meets biophysics, I don't know. It's kind of, I think, it's in the near future, maybe it's happening right now, but I hope it will be happening very soon.
So on your previous slide, when you say mutations with unknown functions, that means things that just come from sequencing.
Yes, sequencing sometimes.
So we presume that those mutations are not causing a disease because those are not people that are like coming, showing up at a clinic with some disease.
Well, even if you say sequence and you know that, say cancer patient or a particular patient with a particular disease, and you have this mutation, you don't know what this mutation does to the, say, protein or to regulation.
Okay.
So they are unannotated in this case. So first, actually, I want to regroup my talk, because first I wanted to talk about more evolution of protein interactome and how we design methods to construct human protein interactome with resolved interfaces, and how we use evolutionary methods of deciding which interface would be evolutionary concept or not. But then after listening talks for the last 2 days, I thought maybe I'll focus right now, because I will not finish the whole talk. I'll focus on the impact of missense mutations, because we heard about mutations and missense mutations, but what do they do to proteins, to their stability, binding, and activity is really important to decipher these particular topics. So why do we need to learn about the mechanisms of effects of mutations on proteins? Of course, to understand how proteins evolve. For example, if protein evolve a different specificity to particular substrate, how it can do it. To predict which mutations are damaging, to answer your question. Because if we see that this particular mutation might really destabilize protein or might disrupt or overstabilize protein-protein interaction or might affect function, it could be damaging. Also to distinguish functionally important mutations from like neutral mutations, especially it is the unsolved problem for cancer. And again, I'll talk about driving passenger mutations, which mutations actually give advantage to the tumor cell and which do not. Of course, if we can distinguish driver from passenger mutations, we can prioritize mutations for experimental research, because for drug design, you know, quite often you design inhibitors which will target particular mutant. For example, for many chemotherapy drugs which target particular, say, receptor tyrosine kinases or something else. So what this mutation can do to proteins, because we study proteins, so we proteins, it could affect thermodynamic stability and make protein pretty much actually unfolded, which could also consequently cause aggregation, non-specific aggregation, and lead to very kind of undesirable results. Of course, missense mutation can result in can affect binding to other biomolecules in the cell. Protein function it's in general encompasses all of this, but mutation can occur in functionally important site or specificity determining sites in the protein. Of course, protein structure like lead to non-specific protein aggregation, and missense mutations may affect sites which can potentially be post-translationally modified. And this is also very important. So there are a number of experimental and computational techniques which assess whether mutations are damaging or not. Among computational techniques, they're called functional prediction or phenotypic a prediction of effects of mutations. These techniques usually just give you information, okay, if mutation is damaging for a protein or not damaging for a protein, kind of give you a binary classification with different, sometimes different levels of probability assigned to this classification. But they will not provide you what does this mutation do to your protein, what are molecular mechanisms of effect of this mutation, if it's damaging, what does it do? And these methods, they all use this observation that evolutionary conservation is related to functional importance. So if we, in this, say, alignment of particular family, this site is, say, 100% conserved, it's probably is functionally important. So substitutions, amino acid substitutions in this particular site, other than particular residue which is conserved, would probably lead to disruption of function, so will be damaging. And this is their strength, and this is also drawback of these methods, because there is so much kind of focus on using this evolutionary conservation feature. And why it is drawback? Because we know the first problem to construct alignments, correct alignments, evolutionary alignments, especially for diverse sequences. On the contrary, if protein family has very similar sequences, you also will not have a signal-to-noise ratio will be very low, and all positions will be equally conserved, basically. So it's also not good. So they are very biased towards multiple sequence alignment methods, and in terms of multiple sequence alignment methods, the still accuracy of them is limited, as we know. And another thing, most of these methods are machine learning, so they are trained. They are trained to distinguish that, like using known databases of damage, like disease-associated mutations and neutral mutations. They are trained to distinguish disease-associated mutations from neutral mutations. And so, and you know, like training, they train using all available data, whatever we have. So it's difficult really to assess their performance as well. But they are very, very useful, and they are widely used, especially in genomics community. Yes.
Could you explain the axis on your graph?
Oh yes, this I actually didn't tell you. So this is this basically illustrates kind of the limitation of using just evolutionary conservation. Basically, if a site is not very conserved, the accuracy of prediction damaging mutations drops. Vice versa for neutral mutations, for the reason which I explained below, because. There are damaging mutations occurring in non-conserved sites. We know that there are many of them. But if you use this, more or less explicitly evolutionary conservation, then this will be a certain drawback of that.
So what is the red?
This is accuracy of damaging mutations, and blue one accuracy of like neutral SNPs. But again, these neutral SNPs, they are taken mostly from DBSNP database, which also has some damaging mutations, but majority of them are neutral.
But that's accuracy of some program that predicts?
Yes. They compile different programs.
The rate categories, that's based on comparing a bunch of mammals, or what?
This is damaging, I think it's Mendelian mutations which cause Mendelian.
Oh, but the rate categories, how are those?
Oh, evolutionary rate, I think it's basically using PAML, they calculated evolutionary rate for each site.
This is mammals?
Could use from this paper, I don't remember how. I don't think only mammals, just, yeah.
One other quick question there. In terms of how they're deciding what's damaging, is this just sort of catch-all thing that depends on who measured it where, or is there, because it's a bit surprising that there would be, in something that's highly conserved, that there would be no effect, right? So that's
this is surprising, but like I mentioned, because in DBSNP database, there are some damaging mutations, probably. So, I mean, you know, there are probably some of them, because, you know, the classification is not perfect. But overall trend is.
Can ask maybe a variation one. So what is a damaging mutation? What is it defined as a damaging mutation?
Well, damaging mutation, again, people define it differently. There could be damaging mutations which cause Mendelian diseases, where one mutation is directly associated with, say, disease phenotype. For cancer mutations, it's more complicated. And as far as I remember, in this paper, they just use Mendelian mutations. So it's known that this particular mutation causes this particular disease. So it's damaging.
I thought that was disease-associated mutation. I thought that's what that was.
Yeah. It's disease-associated mutation. Well,
yeah.
Whatever, yeah. It is damaging disease-associated mutations, yes. Yeah.
So it has to be a mutation, not that is known, biochemically to disrupt the function of the protein. It has to be a mutation that has clearly been demonstrated to be associated with the disease.
Disease, yeah. There are definitions could be different. I mean, here it's, yes, disease-associated mutation, basically. The mutation which associated with disease. What does it do? It's another question to the, say, protein or...
And how big are these databases? Are we talking about how big are the databases from which this data is drawn?
OMIM has about 3,000 mutations. OMIM for Mendelian disease mutations, 3,000. And say databases which store cancer mutations, they have like COSMIC, TCGA. I mean, they have actually hundreds of mutations which were observed in cancer patients. Okay, so one of the way to decipher molecular basis of mutations and what do they do to proteins is to look at the structures. And why? Because quite often mutations do change conformations. Basically, proteins exist in as an assembly of different conformations, and mutation or whatever you can, post-translational modification, can basically shift this equilibrium towards different conformational substates. And sometimes the substates can have different activities, so mutation can have can activate protein or inactivate protein. So, and mutations quite often disrupt interaction networks. They can affect stability and binding. And so, I mean, this information can be obtained, like about stability, how it affects binding, can be obtained if we know the structure or structural model of a protein. So we, since we, I mean, our one of the main projects in the group is related to studying protein-protein interactions, we wanted to design a method how to assess the effect of amino acid substitution. And here I will use the term mutation because it's just easier. Mutation on protein-protein binding affinity. And I was surprised that this problem is so difficult. You would think that, okay, you substitute one amino acid, I mean, you shouldn't, backbone shouldn't really change much. I mean, you can really sample rotamers and predict energy, but actually it's very difficult. I was surprised by that. And so we, what we do, our approaches, of course, first you need to have energy function to calculate this difference in binding. So, and the binding, change on binding energy between basically binding affinity of wild type complex and binding affinity of mutant complex, where don't have a formula here. Basically, binding affinity will be the unfolding free energy of the complex minus unfolding free energy of each monomer. And there could be different approaches how to estimate this binding affinity. One of the approaches using atomic force fields is called molecular mechanics Poisson-Boltzmann surface area approach, which basically shows here you can decompose your energy into molecular mechanics term, and also the terms which account for interaction of your solute with a solvent. Solvent including ions, certain distribution of ions. And this interaction with solvent, we show it's very important to account for the interaction with the solvent. And it comes from the polar salvation term and non-polar salvation term, which is basically proportional to the surface area of the interface of the protein. And entropy term is usually ignored, and actually they kind of cancel out because you subtract these energies and they cancel out. And they, in general, the estimating entropy error is huge. We tried it, but error is really, really big. So, yeah.
So just a basic question. So you're saying protein A binds to protein B, and protein A can either be wild type or mutant. And you're comparing how A binds to B when A is wild type versus when A is mutant.
Yes, yes.
And so if delta delta G is positive, then the mutant is preferred?
Yeah. It depends how you define this. I mean, you can define folding free energy or unfolding free energy. So in general, for our later on, if delta delta G is positive, it means it's destabilizing this particular interaction.
Okay. So the mutation would be preferred over the
wild type. Yeah.
I was just intrigued because you mentioned the relevance of the difference of conformational substates.
Yes.
Which I have long been interested in and seemed important. But of course, the problem is, how do you know those? And
yes.
Is that embodied in, or you're about to tell me?
Yes, I'm going to tell you. So energy function is one kind of way. We need energy function, and overall, we try different, we try MMPBSA, we call it modified. We tried also including some other terms. In this paper, we came up with just three terms, well, four parameters and three energy terms. One of them accounts for polar salvation term, interaction with solvent. This is a change of interface area and change in van der Waals energy. But later on, as I'll show you, we came up with, we think, a better energy function, which basically uses atomic force fields, but also kind of idea from bioinformatics and evolution. So another thing, like David, so this is not yet. So this is our basically new energy function where these terms are shown contribute statistically significant to the quality of the model. Because of course you can include 100 terms into your energy and they all will be interdependent and they will not statistically significant really contribute to the quality of the model. So, and there are actually machine learning methods which include like 100 different terms. So what we found also that accounting for evolutionary conservation can actually be quite sometimes be beneficial because we know there are binding hotspot residues on the binding interfaces. It meaning that substituting this binding hotspot residue into another amino acid will really change binding affinity, well, more than 2 kilocalorie per mole, say. So in these binding hotspots, they are more evolutionary conserved than the rest of the interface. So after we, again, I'll tell you, looked at and compared with experimental values of delta delta G, we found that these actually terms are important to account. Actually, unfolding free energy here in this particular energy function will also account for unfolding free energies because you think that mutation will make protein unfolded, it will not bind. Although not always, of course, it could be disordered or the transition and so on, but still. So, and like to answer David's question, so we need also to design a protocol how to predict a mutant, basically, how to model a mutant. And this means we need to assess, ensemble of conformations in general. So, and we have to design minimization protocol. And there are many minimization protocols. And we tried different kind of protocols with different parameters, with different solvent models, explicit, implicit solvent model, gas phase. Now we kind of use minimization of the gas phase because it's faster, because speed is also a really important factor. We are dealing with hundreds of mutations. And you have to be able to actually calculate this binding affinities not in the order of hours, but on the order of seconds or at least minutes. Yeah.
Let me go back to the last slide. I just want to make sure I'm understanding what's going on there. So, the first thing is you can imagine giving you an actual energy, but the evolutionary conservation, that's just a heuristic, right?
Yeah, so you can say it's core now. You cannot call, you don't need to call it energy right now. So you can call it score, energy base score, for example. So this is kind of, yeah.
And where do something like either the hydrophobicity or charge-charge interactions, is that included in this? Or?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They, I mean, all this, yeah, van der Waals, polar salvation terms, so they all, yeah.
Did I understand you correctly? You're putting evolutionary conservation as kind of a score, as sort of a pseudo energy term, or did I?
Well, yeah, it's like score. You can call it all the scores. Yeah, evolutionary conservation enters as a score. Yeah.
Okay.
It's tricky because I would say maybe I'll show later. Most of the mutations which occur, well, say like that. Mutations which would affect protein-protein binding, they are most likely will occur on interface, and not just on interface, in the core of the interface, basically inside the interface. So, but there are mutations which are located kind of on the other side of the protein, and they can be kind of allosterically affect protein-protein binding. Predicting them would be really difficult. So it's we have. I mean,
if you put in some like evolutionary conservation, how do you partition it from the other energy terms?
What do you mean partition? Oh, but this is okay. The parameters, there are parameters in front of each linear combination of that, and each like you can do linear regression and train these parameters in front of each energy term.
Okay.
Or we use a random forest, or you could use linear regression. So this is trained. You trained it on the experimental data, these parameters.
And what are you minimizing here? Energy? Or
yeah.
Total energy
yeah.
from all five of the things you
trained? Oh, no, no. We minimize here.
Yes.
No, here just energy, like for no evolutionary conservation here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
Four?
Yeah, basically. So minimization protocols we try different, as I mentioned. So they're important. This is what I want to say. This is a correlation with experimental data. You see, depending on how many minimization steps you use, you could start from 3.5 and you go to 0.5, but it's really important. And we try different with flexible backbone, with restraints on backbone, without restraints. Also, we tried do sampling with MD simulations, with them, one on a second MD simulations, and I'll show you the results later. So we design our methods, and I'll show you also, usually when we make a method, we make a server that you, or everybody can use it. But the point of this slide is not even show the difference between the methods or so on, just to show you overall performance which you could achieve in general for this type of predictions. And this is, you can look at the, basically we use experimental data of experimental delta delta G values. It's about 2,000 mutations from so-called SCMPI database. And these RAC curves show you the performance of retrieval of true positives and false positives. So true positives, basically, it's a fraction of correctly predicted deleterious mutations. And deleterious here are defined as those mutations which destabilize protein complex by 2 kilocalories per mole. So they are deleterious mutations experimentally. This is from experiments. So how well we can predict these deleterious mutations? So deleterious mutations we can predict pretty well. Neutral mutations, which do not destabilize complex so much, so it's like plus minus between minus 2 plus 2 kilocalories per mole. For neutral mutations, the performance is okay. And this is for SCMPI database with many cross-validations. And this is another target 55, which is from Capri experiments, absolutely kind of independent target. And it's not as maybe great performance. And for target 56, I mean, none of the methods really could predict anything relevant. So it's really, really difficult target, yeah.
Are these single step mutations from, I mean, you've got a target structure that you're using to make the predictions?
Yes, the structure is
a single step mutations from that? Single step mutations from the target?
What do you mean single step?
I mean, the more mutations you go from a crystallized structure, the less I usually believe the.
Well, yeah, prediction. The thing is, experimental data in this target, usually they're all single mutants. There are some double and triple mutants, but very few of them. And yes, we investigated separately how you can predict double mutation. There are some positive epistasis for that. I mean, mutations you could, well, actually it's for cancer mutations, so it's not for that project. But majority of them single mutations. So even predicting even single mutations is problematic. And here I show you deleterious and neutral, and there are stabilizing mutations, which actually stabilize proteins complex. It is almost impossible to predict them correctly. And one of the reasons, because experimental data have quite few of them. So you really cannot really train your parameters, whatever you, well, basically none of the methods predict them correctly. And we know that in cancer, and we showed when we studied, there are some mutations which stabilize, over-stabilize transient protein complex. Because this binding should be reversible. And these mutations can be pretty damaging. But for us right now, it's impossible to
predict. Can you explain these graphs? I'm having a hard time understanding.
Yeah, so, okay.
I understand what true positive.
Yeah, so from experimental data basically gives you value of delta delta G, how much this mutation will affect, will be. So we basically classify these experimental mutations into deleterious, which destabilize complex by 2 kilocalorie per mole, neutral, which will be around zero.
What I don't understand
is rock. Okay.
Why do things go, why can you have a true false positive rate of one and a false positive rate of one?
Well, that's always because when you do retrieval, you get basically you rank mutations with respect to the score, and when you with certain score which is very high, everything will be there, the whole database will be there, so all true positives and all false positives will be there. So what you do here, you basically using this particular method, you rank your all mutations with respect to say increasing score. Yeah, like starting that this mutation has this score, this mutation has this score, this mutation has this score. And then you slide your score cutoff. Do you want me, I can draw? Yeah?
Maybe everybody else understands.
Yeah. Okay.
No.
You would know afterwards.
Standard feature, Sam.
To me, a false positive would be you're looking at something that isn't, I guess in your words, dangerous, but you say it is.
Yeah, false positive will be, we predict that this mutation will be deleterious, but it's not deleterious according to experiments, above this core threshold.
Actually, I'll give an analogy here. You've got a test that is trying to figure out the smart students from the bad students, and a good test is going to identify all the smart students, and also appropriately, so give A to the smart students and F to the bad students. But at the far upper right-hand corner, what you're doing is you're giving an A to all students. So you correctly identify all the smart ones, but you also incorrectly identify all the stupid ones. Right? So the test at the far right is giving an A.
Sums up modern education.
Yes.
That would have been easier.
So,
you know, can I just interject? I mean, one thing I think that people sometimes have problems when they're first looking at that is that understanding that these lines are composed of just different settings for the filters, different parameter settings. So they're just constructed by taking whatever the parameter settings are from get nothing to get everything, and they're filtering it. You're sort of looking at different settings that might filter it in different ways.
We can talk later. Yeah. So the random retrieval will be basically the main diagonal on this graph, so which you could see like here, like there.
And all of these different methods are using the same data sets, but there's two different data sets. Is that right?
Well, some methods like BitMusic is trained on this data set. It's important to say MMPBC is not trained. This is just force field. And you see, just using force field, just it will not achieve sometimes very good accuracy.
What is the second set of graphs? Target 55.
Well, target 55 is a target which they used in this Capri experiments, which basically it has nothing to do with this Campy data set. From David Baker's lab, there was a protein, and he performed all many, like couple hundreds of mutations, and recorded. It's not actually binding energy, some enrichment which is correlated with binding energy difference. So this is kind of independent target. It's an independent protein target, which you can.
So there's two different data sets and different methods being used to analyze two different data sets.
Yeah. Actually, I even kind of didn't want to emphasize the difference between methods. I just want to say what is the current limitation of all these methods. So its accuracy is far from 100%. They cannot predict stabilizing mutations, but it seems like prediction of deleterious mutations could be achievable. And what would be the factors influencing prediction quality? So, of course, location for mutations, like I mentioned, if mutations are located in the core of the interface, this is cross-section, then overall its effect on binding will be larger and it's easy to predict it. And for those mutations which are located on not on the interface, really they will not have much effect usually. Well, basically it's kind of less than KT, so like no effect, so, and it's difficult to predict them. Another factor.
Wait, sorry. Yes. Could you repeat that last statement? Because what?
Which last statement? Well, this is 0.5 kilocalorie per mole, so it's like.
You said they won't, I thought you said they won't have much effect, therefore it's difficult to predict them?
It's not like logically. They do not affect. And it's difficult to predict them. So.
And the whole interface between the two is green, yellow, and orange?
Yes. So this is interface, core, support, and rim. And this is non-interface region. Yeah.
So if you were to put a logic behind that?
Sorry?
If you were to put a logic behind that,
why would mutations located, say, in the core would affect?
Or the other way around, the ones that are on the.
Well, they are there. So if they are interactions, they are disrupting interactions, they would highly likely affect. But other mutations.
I guess I'll say specifically what I'm thinking about is that it seems to me possible. So this came up the other day in a talk the other day about disordered regions.
Yeah.
But I would speculate that the things that are on the surface are not affecting the target structure as much, but they're still maybe equally likely to affect the substate, the alternative substates, and the other structures, maybe. And those are the ones that are.
It is possible. Yes.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, kind of statistically, that. In majority of the cases, they don't. Of course, there are cases where they do. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm also trying to understand the statistics here. So the error bar. So if most of the mutations in the interior have no effect, but some do have an effect, wouldn't we expect a large error bar?
This error bar. This is mean value, and this is standard error for all mutations from experimental database. So.
So the range is quite big. So presumably there's some negative ones as well, right?
Yeah, there are some negative ones, yeah. But not so many, like stabilizing. Yeah, but not so many. So.
How are you defining support and rim?
Well, this is from Emmanuel Levy's paper. This is his definition. And we found this definition useful in our studies. So. And it basically, you find the definitions based on some accessible area of certain interface residues.
Follow up on the question, but suppose you want to know for some other protein?
Sorry, Inge?
Suppose you want to know what core and support is for some other.
There are many proteins here from this database. It's not just one protein. This is just an illustration. Actually, in the SCAMPI database, there are about 100 proteins with experimental values of delta delta G. And these predictions can be made based on structure. If you know the structure of a complex,
so there is some well-defined algorithm that you're just not telling us.
And assign these regions, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't quite understand, but and that algorithm is based on measurements, or it's still purely computational based on structure?
Well, it's based on structure and measurements of like solvent accessible area of the interface.
So structure and some additional measurements.
Well, yeah, from structure you have a coordinates and you can measure.
Computation.
Yeah, well, yes, yeah.
Just one other question. Are these homomers or heteromers?
They're mixed. They're basically different types of complexes, yeah. So, I mean, another factor is, probably I should speed up, yeah. volume, I mean, you would expect that the volume and charge of amino acids change dramatically. It would produce high effects, not usual, but it seems like it's easy to predict if you substitute large into small or small into large and positive into negative, for negative into positive, we didn't have enough statistics. So. Low accuracy of prediction stabilizing mutations, as I show here. Okay, David's question about how sampling this conformation will actually affect. So we found that averaging over ensemble produced by MD simulations does not help at all. The correlation, again, overall, I mean, for this 2,000 of mutations, correlation drops significantly. And this is an illustration how in MD you actually, you kind of sample conformation which is not accessible in native structure. This is conformation produced by minimization. And minimization, basically, you go downhill of energy without crossing energy barriers. You just go downhill. And in MD simulations, you can go uphill and cross some energy barriers and sample more kind of more conformations. So you see what happens in MD average structure. You make this very stable interaction with this, as you see, this extra hydrogen bonds between serine and glutamate, between these residues and red one. Although in minimized and crystal structure, you don't have this interaction. So basically, the program, of course, I mean, it's really would be really stable conformation in MD, but it will not be native-like. So we were not successful with averaging over MD ensemble, and it actually agrees with other studies using MMPB same method. Well. Some other studies, it's controversial. And we designed a server, which is called MutaBind.
So these things that you just talked to us about, these are things that you know are important based on the comparison between the way that your
it's experimental
modeling was compared to the other things that you showed us.
Yes, it's all everything. This correlation is compared with experiments. Of method of our computational method to predict delta delta g, and we compare with experiment with experimental delta delta g, and this is a correlation.
Maybe this is beside the point. So now you can go back and say your method was better than these other methods. Do you understand why, or are these the factors that you think are important in distinguishing your method from other methods?
No, these are methods which influence overall prediction accuracy.
Okay, for everything.
Yeah. Okay. Other methods are not, they are machine learning, so you cannot use MD there, but so you cannot really compare these methods, machine learning methods, with MD and without MD. So, but okay. Overall, these are different. Yeah.
I'm sorry, but I keep letting you out of this, but when you say averaging over molecular dynamic simulations, does that mean that you're getting the average stability over the MD conformation?
It's average structure. So you frames, you store frames while you do one on a second MD simulations, and for the last one you equilibrated structure for the last, say, 100 frames, 1,000 frames, you calculate the average structure, basically. This is...
Yeah, so I guess what I was wondering more was whether mutations, not whether if you just treated that as an average structure, but whether the mutations were stabilizing some substructures over other substructures.
You see, we will never be able to, we tried just final structure of TMD, it didn't work. I mean, how would you know which frame, which of this conformation along MD trajectories to use? You would never... Like, if you don't know experiments, yeah?
Well, yeah, I was thinking
how would you know? So,
yeah, I don't know if I believe that MD will really sample the relevant substructures, but would have been my next question, too,
So this is our server. You input your PDB codes, it calculates by assembly, so a symmetric unit for structural biologists. So, and mutation, you put also mutation which is located, and it calculates actually the change in delta delta G, and we want to add also binding affinity calculation for protein-protein interaction, assessing the binding energy. And now I want to, I have some time, I want to tell you kind of specific stories, specific cases. And we work on several projects with experimental groups in collaboration with experimentalists. And this particular project is on CBL, ubiquitin ligase, on cancer mutations. I have been talking about association of whatever, mutations with disease phenotype. And now I want to associate how mutations affecting this gene, CBL gene, will be associated with the function of this protein and with disease phenotype. Disease phenotype here is cancer. And just tell you some words. Cancer. Mutations, there are hundreds of cancer mutations recorded in the databases. Most of them, I would say maybe 98% of them are somatic. So they are not inherited. They occur in tumor cells because of different reasons. Some of them are inherited, but majority of them are not. And moreover, because of this cancer.
Inherited, you mean passed on in the cancer lineage or passed on in the germline?
Germline, yeah. They are not germline. They are not passed to.
They're certainly passed on in the cancer.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. So another terminology, driving passenger. Driver cancer mutations, they give advantage to cancer cell proliferate and avoid apoptosis. And passenger mutations, they do not. And there are a lot of supposedly passenger mutations in among the all cancer mutations just because cancer cells, they divide a lot. So they accumulate. And there are, I mean, really, some people say, okay, there are only really among all this several hundred mutations, only about 10 or 20 driver mutations. There are no more. And whatever we are sequencing right now, all the cancer mutations, I mean, number of driver mutations will not really increase, so it will be again P53, GFR, KIT, P10, all these driver genes. But there are other people say that actually it's not the case. So it's really complicated. The story is complicated yet because, you know, you can see with machine learning methods, you can distinguish cancer mutations from non-cancer mutations because you train, you know, okay, this is all cancer mutations, this is a cancer mutation database, and this is neutral mutation. I train my method to distinguish cancer mutations from non-cancer. And you can,
How?
Well, like any machine learning method, you know classification and you train your model to discriminate between cancer and non-cancer.
Based on structure?
Oh, no. These like methods which I mentioned to you, phenotypic prediction, they are not usually used structure sequence. So, but the question is, you really have to distinguish not cancer from non-cancer, but driver from passenger. And this is basically like I show you, none of the method can reliably distinguish driver from passenger because there are no databases which could tell you that these mutations are driver and these mutations are passenger. Anyway, so.
Sorry,
yeah. Yes.
I missed what a driver was and passenger. Again, could you repeat that?
Yeah, so driver mutations are those mutations which give some advantage to tumor cell to proliferate, to avoid apoptosis, so that actually tumor cells can divide and proliferate. So, and passenger mutations, apparently, they do not. They just kind of random mutations occurring in the population, like, and just, they do not, they don't, they are not selected in the tumor. Well, yeah, so I guess.
And the databases from which this is coming?
So there are like cosmic database, which kind of, it's in Sanger Institute, and it encompasses a lot of mutations, but also there is a NIH project, TCGA, also there are mutations coming, cancer mutations coming from this project.
And the distinguishing of who's a driver and who's a passenger, like how is that?
Well, this is what I'm going to address. It's difficult.
So the,
yeah.
the database just says,
yeah,
these are mutations that are found in some large number. This is like the, what's called the 1,000 cancer genome.
Yes,
project.
Yes. It will tell you, well, information, will, yeah, it will tell you how many patients will have these mutations. It will tell you like homozygous, heterozygous. It will tell you, sometimes it will predict some effect. There are experimental studies on some of the driver genes and driver mutations.
But a pretty small percentage, right?
Yeah, compared to all mutations.
So
yeah.
It's correlations. It's mutations that are.
Yeah.
I'm trying to get you to tell me what these are.
Driver mutations, you mean?
Well, cancer associated.
Well, cancer, just because they happen to be a cancer patient. They observe what they do, they sequence somatic cell,
right.
And then they, with tumor, and then they sequence, for example, some blood cell,
yeah,
to for the background, yeah, so to understand whether this is a germline mutation or some, and then they compare and say, okay, this is somatic mutation, and it happens in a cancer patient. Okay. So this is a... So this is Sibyl ubiquitin ligase example, basically just it's important protein because it involves in basically this is E3 Cbl ubiquitin ligase. It binds to the substrate. I'll tell you about substrate later. And then it binds to this conjugating enzyme E2, which is attached to ubiquitin, and then transfers during this process. It transfers ubiquitin to the substrate. And then the substrate is targeted for degradation after ubiquitination. And why it is important? Because also the substrate are a receptor tyrosine kinases, especially EGFR. And we know that EGFR is aberrantly activated in cancer, and it's mutated in especially in lung cancer. So it is important because it seems like CBL is actually targets this EGFR for degradation. But moreover, actually there are more than 100 mutations observed in CBL gene in cancer patients, which also like makes it an important target to study. And when we, I mean, when this experimental group contacted us, we thought, okay, we might have structure of CBL in the PDB, but we were lucky. Actually, there were several structures of CBL which captures this protein in different stages of its activation cycle. And this is really important because when, like, say, people say methods, they use structure to predict the effect of mutations. But again, mutation might have quite different effect on active and inactive state and in different states of activation. So in general, ideally, you have to assess this effect at different stages. So what happens is it's in inactive state and CBL has a closed conformation. Then when the substrate binds, CBL opens up a little bit. And then when conjugating enzyme binds here, and there is a tyrosine residue which gets phosphorylated. And it uses very large conformational change after phosphorylation of this tyrosine. And this is active structure of the complex. This is an active structure. This is partially open, and this is closed structure. Okay, so first what we did, we applied methods to assess effect of this cancer mutations of CBL on CBL unfolding free energy and on binding between CBL and E2. And here, this is a distribution of delta G. This is stability. Basically, this shows that this is how this destabilizes the structure of CBL closed form. And I mean, I don't show you for all four states here. This is a recurrent mutation, which means this mutation is observed in at least two cancer patients. And this is single mutation, which means just in one patient. We don't know. And this random, and random is a whole story how to simulate random mutations. So overall, what we see that recurrent cancer mutations, they have overall more destabilizing effect than the single mutation. And here also on binding, the effect on binding not as pronounced as on folding, but still it's a statistically significant destabilizing effect. And actually effect on active conformation is more pronounced than the effect of inactive conformation. But what is really important here to say, okay, well, you have these mutations, say, maybe many of them passenger, you should compare to some kind of background distribution, to random mutations. And what does it mean random? So random here, and this is maybe a question to many of you, how to simulate random spectrum. So random here, we simulated random basically mutating the CBL permissible amino acid substitutions. So each site would be mutated into several permissible amino acid substitutions and calculating all this delta, delta G. But we know there are underlying mutagenesis processes, which, for example, if there is CpG island, that will be, if like say methylated, it will be more mutable. And the CpG islands, they encode for arginine. So if a protein arginine rich, maybe this is what you kind of expect. So now we are trying actually we're designing a method to evaluate this random, kind of random amino acid substitution spectrum based on underlying mutagenesis processes. If there is mutational hotspots, for example, in this gene, so to take this into account. But right now, well, again, we will have a survey on that coming soon, but right now for this particular problem, we didn't have it yet. But any ideas are welcome. I don't know how really to simulate this random mutation spectrum for comparison.
Is that p-value, just the distributions are different?
It's mean values, so it is a test which checks if mean values of this distribution are significantly different, yeah. And of course, you see that single mutation spectrum is very much like random mutations, so maybe majority of these mutations are actually passenger mutations. So another, of course, thing is that the spectrum are shifted towards positive values, which is, we know that majority of mutations are destabilizing for proteins. So that the even random mutation spectrum, it will be a little bit shifted towards positive values.
Okay. Some of these could actually be influencing the catalytic efficiency
enzyme.
This
you're
just measuring stability.
Yeah, this is what I'm going to show you. Okay, so this is, I'll probably skip some factors, like we looked at heterozygous, homozygous mutations, leukemia mutations versus other cancer types, so also differences. But then our experimental collaborators basically, well, measured activity, ligase activity of CBL for different mutants. So mutants were randomly, they were blind tests. They were randomly selected from different groups of damaging, not damaging, and kind of in between, about 15 mutants. And they use different cell lines, this human embryonic kidney cells. This is a cell lung cancer cells, HeLa cervical cancer cells. And basically, with these plasmids, with these genes of EGFR and CBL, mutant, wild type, and also ubiquitin, which was hemagglutinin intact, with the hemagglutinin intact ubiquitin, they were transfected into the cell lines. And what was measured, that ability of CBL to ubiquitinate EGFR. So if you see here the big difference between wild type and this mutants. It means that the ability, at least ubiquitinate ligase activity, was largely impaired. And all this was quantified, like densitometry data were obtained. And overall, these are mutations. This is experimental densitometry data. This is effect on stability of different states. This is effect on binding affinity. And here I decided not to list methods. These are different methods of phenotypic prediction of effects. So what we see that for damaging, for highly damaging mutations, which impair this ligase activity, they correlate pretty well with stability of closed state. Again, correlated at least, except for, well, for all of them, they are destabilizing. For binding affinity, for active state, but not for inactive state. And for neutral mutations, even though they are cancer, they are from cancer patients, they do not affect activity or stability or binding, anything. They are probably passenger mutations. These are green ones. And these mutations are somewhere in between, which, like, these mutations was kind of affecting stability, but it wasn't in kind of partially affecting activity. So there is overall good agreement between this data, these calculations, which take into account thermodynamic stability and binding, but like methods which predict based on, say, like I mentioned, phenotypic prediction effect, methods which use basically training, most of them, they kind of fail for most of the parts in their overall, they overpredict damaging effect of mutations. The best method I just mentioned was Provin, and this method accounts for alignment inaccuracies, which is important. So
I like the second method, it's the one that gave everybody A's.
Well, yes, so that's why I put this, I decided today in the morning, I thought maybe I should, yeah. So this is overall, they seems like they are over-predicting the damaging effects, so.
Could you go back two slides? I thought you had it, you went back pretty fast.
This one?
Zygosity there?
Yes, zygosity. So I don't, this is like homozygous seems to be more destabilizing effect. I don't know quite why.
So that means the mutation is homozygous in somatic tissues?
Yeah.
But do we know whether they were inherited this time?
Well, it seems like.
How did you get to be homozygous? Was it a gene, a single mutation and a gene conversion?
Well, I don't know underlying mechanism, but there are among cancer mutations, somatic cancer mutations, there are many homozygous mutations. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you could have, I mean, some of them are loss of, what's called loss of heterozygosity.
Yeah, yes, I recommend it, yeah.
But these also have heterozygous effects.
Yeah.
Do you know the frequency of that, Lynn?
No, that's why I was, I mean, this is sort of, it becomes an interesting issue to think about the evolution of cancer causing genes because if they're recessive, then they can rise to higher frequency. It's inherited.
But again, they are like what they are inactivating, they are impaired ubiquitin ligase function, but they give advantage, they are selected by tumor. So
I'm talking about polymorphisms.
And overall, if you look at the correlation, I mean, you try to correlate maybe this densitometry data, which quantify the change in activity with stability and binding, actually, you see pretty high correlation, which is nonlinear because it's logarithmic scale, so it's like Boltzmann-like behavior. So for binding, correlation is significant, especially if you remove these two very destabilizing mutations, but overall it's not as good as for effect on stability. So stability destabilizing protein is directly correlated with the change of its ubiquitin ligase activity. And just to show you what these mutations actually locally do to this protein. So this is a wild type. This is this mutant, which is highly damaging. It is inactivating, and it's predicting to be inactivating. So what happens here, you see wild type, you see mutant. And you see wild type, there is some salt bridges formed here, which is disrupted in the mutant. And moreover, upon binding to E2, remember there was phosphorylation. So this phosphate group of phosphorylated tyrosine forms a salt bridge with this lysine, which is also disrupted by this substitution. So just this gives you an idea what happens on the molecular level of the effects of these mutations. And probably I have started already.
It's a quarter to 12.
Yeah. I maybe mentioned just two studies. Oops. On just glioblastoma mutations, and but this was a different approach of calculating energies and everything. Now we are trying to use our new approach to annotate cancer mutations. But just want to show you this plot. This is if you even don't know the structure. If you get your mutation and you say, okay, your alanine is substituted into lysine, you can calculate kind of a distance in the physical chemical space, basically, whatever, don't remember exactly what was this dot product of the vector between the vector of some physical chemical properties of two amino acids. And what happens that actually those amino acid substitutions which are directly located on protein-protein interaction interface, it seems like even from the pure structure, even pure sequence, just knowing, not even pure sequence, just knowing what mutates into what, you can see that they change their physical chemical properties more compared to those mutations which are not located on non-interface for those genes which are mutated in glioblastoma. And how they can affect interaction networks. We constructed, this is, really the second part of my talk, which I don't have even time to go today. So if we construct protein interaction networks from, say, high throughput data, we also can construct protein interaction networks using our approach to construct protein interaction networks with result interfaces. And you can see here that this is nodes and edges shown in red where interactions between proteins where mutations directly located on interface. And these are just interactions between proteins with mutation anywhere in the protein. And then you can analyze the topological properties of these networks for this subnetwork, MI, which is kind of directly disrupted, AI, which is somewhere and other. And basically the basic result, the topological properties of these networks would be different. And interactions with mutations might occur in the central in the central network positions. But this more in detail, I was going to show you in my next. There is another experimental study, but I don't have time to talk about that. Yeah, so this is the first part of my talk. Thank you.
Beautiful hairball.
this is the reality, and this is, this is the reality what people. And this is where you want to go. This is a big difference.
Why can't you only circle exactly circular?
What circular?
Your
graph. This is just the way it is.
Okay, thanks.